When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rabona podcast. Once again, I'm Musa Kwonga. Welcoming back Ryan Hun. Hello, Ryan.
Hello.
And Michael De Silva from his various travels. Hello, Michael.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, homecoming.
A homecoming podcast, the homecast.
The return.
We'll be discussing bonanza of UEFA Nations League action. So much great stuff going on last week. Let's get into it. Michael, where should we start?
We should probably start with the Nations League as a format. It's surprisingly good. I mean, it's added some intensity to what would be kind of pedestrian friendlies. And yeah, I mean, we've seen England versus Croatia, great game. Germany versus Netherlands, great game. There's many other examples. So I'm all for it.
I think what's been fun about the Nations League, and I share a lot of those thoughts. What's funny, I was talking to a friend, it's a bit like the schoolyard kickabouts you had, where you kept score. And he played for like 2 hours. And instead of just like, you know, playing end to end, you were like, oh no, it's 7-6. And it mattered, even though there was almost, do you know what I mean?
Now like, it matters.
Now it matters. And you can see the intensity because, you know, Dejan Lovren's on Instagram, social media, talking trash.
Ramos is talking trash. Some things never change.
But you know what I mean? Like it matters. And you can, and the players are responding in kind.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. And also, you don't have like seven substitutions at halftime and killing the flow of a game. So it feels like a, you know, like league games that we're used to seeing, domestic games, but on international scale. It's great. It's a rare case of UEFA getting it right.
Ooh. Aren't there implications though, maybe, and we love the format, I certainly love the format, are there not implications long-term for the intensity of games played over the course of a season? Because if we've now added the Nations League, you had friendlies before, and there was a sense of taking your foot off the pedal a bit, the international break. But now these games are keenly contested. Is there not a bit of a danger of, a greater danger of burnout for players?
That's an interesting point. I hadn't really thought about it, if I'm being honest. But I don't see it as being a major issue because the Nations League is such a small amount of games and there are still friendlies in between that. Mm-hmm. So it's not completely replaced friendlies. I mean, the top groups, if you're in them, was it Group A or Tier A? You play, what, 6 games? And usually, I think England have pretty much every time had one friendly and one qualifier or something, right?
Don't you play four games?
Four in the top. Can't do maths. But still, so 4 games of higher intensity than, you know, than a friendly, I don't think is really going to affect it too much. And also, even though they have been competitive, you have still seen quite a lot of squad rotation from most of the top teams, actually.
I think this is what players want anyway. Like, I think players want, they don't want to just kind of go through the paces of a walking pace friendly. They want something to play for. And, you know, these guys are competitive even when they're training, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we've seen so many times how, you know, a lot of young players, when they're coming through, get their chance in meaningless friendlies. But then when it comes to competitive games at international level, they maybe just get replaced for the same old same old. And this time you've been able to kind of bed them in a little bit more gradually. Like, you know, Jadon Sancho's played competitive games for England already, which is amazing.
And we've seen, like, just clearly the result of not, you know, if you don't play well, if you don't perform in these four games, then it can impact you. And we've seen it with Germany.
Yeah.
You know, they're now in pot two for European Championship qualifying. That means that they're going to face one of the big teams. Could be England, Spain, Portugal, France. So, you know, they've paid the price. And I think it's also like a, it's almost like a, an ongoing form table, you know, like if you, you want to know who the form teams are in Europe right now, well, you check out the Nations League.
Yeah.
Switzerland, Netherlands, they're right up there.
Yeah, definitely. And that's actually one of my favourite things about the Nations League is that, you know, there are very real consequences to not doing well. I mean, we've seen that with Germany. And I think that's been really good. I mean, one of the things as well, I think we mentioned it really early on. Like one, I think the first round of UEFA Nations League games, I watched like the Georgia game. I think it was like Georgia Latvia or something like that. Mm. And the atmosphere was absolutely unbelievable. And for those kinds of nations as well, you know, like you've seen like Gibraltar and teams like and countries like that, it's been amazing because it's brought them on a bit more of a level playing field with their opposition and it's given them competitive wins,
well,
which is
a lot more of a level playing field. They do, you know, there's no fun in Gibraltar going to Italy and getting hammered 7-0. What's the point?
Yeah.
It doesn't help them. It doesn't help them develop as a nation. So, yeah.
And I don't know the science behind it, but I can imagine that that's only a good thing for further development in those nations in terms of if they can actually then progress up to a higher tier, play better teams, and then, but then, you know, it's a lot more relative as opposed to them being in a group with like Germany or well, maybe not Germany anymore, but Portugal, you know.
It is relative though.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever level you're at, if you're playing competitive games, it's going to help your growth.
Yeah.
It's going to improve competition. And I think for too long, there were too many mismatches, especially in European Championship qualifying. World Cup, it was always a bit more intense, but yeah, it was always just a walkover for those teams. It was pointless, really.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this is cool. And I'm looking forward to the finals even next summer. I mean, it's not really not a classic tournament or anything, but it's going to be fun.
Hey, it's a trophy. Is it a trophy?
Probably.
And you say it's not a classic tournament, but what I love about the four teams that have gone through, they've all been rewarded for collective. Like there's no, you look at those teams, England, Switzerland, Portugal, and Netherlands, and they're all teams which put the collective above the individual.
Mm.
They're not serving one ego. They're not led by, you know, one or two superstars. Mm. It really is, you know, these are teams that play good football the way that Switzerland dismantled Belgium. I mean, they dissected them, and Shaqiri, you know, there's a player that's bided his time, almost like, you know, his season is almost a metaphor for Switzerland's evolution through this Nations League. They've really bided their time, and he's bided his time. He's waited on the bench a few games at Liverpool, and he's just exploded into life. And Switzerland have too, and they caught Belgium cold. And what I love about this tournament, like you say, it is a realistic form guide, and I also love the fact it's so precarious.
Yeah.
Like going into the last 10 minutes of some of these games, like teams were staying up or going down.
Yeah, exactly.
Five minutes
from the end of Germany's game against Netherlands, they were surviving. They were going through they were avoiding going into pot two, at least in European Championship. And Netherlands weren't, it was going to be France that would be in the finals.
Yeah.
And it just all flipped in 5 minutes. It was
and you
really
can tell
cool.
These games matter because look how they're ending.
Yeah.
Look how they're ending. You know, late goal, Depay gets a Panenka against France. A Panenka, my goodness.
Hold me.
Late goals for Holland, late goals for England. Like, it's just...
Yeah, that's cool because so many international games, especially qualifiers, are just, they're done at halftime.
Yeah.
Or they have been in the past. And I think that's a good thing. And yeah, it's not a classic tournament yet, but because it's the first round, the first edition of
it.
You know,
could be, yeah.
You know, classic albums aren't classic when they drop. You know what I mean?
Having said that, in defense of classic albums, Outkast, Aquemini. Some of us knew it was a Stone Cold Killer. Some of us knew 1998, Moment of Truth. Sorry, listen. Will it back. Gangsta, Moment of Truth. Listen, I'm sorry to put the grit in the oyster.
Hey, someone's got to do it.
But segue, because we discussed the Nations League as a format, which we seem to think is great. But the Netherlands, actually, they're interesting too, because they and their coach, Ronald Koeman, have had a renaissance, really, haven't they, in recent months?
Well, it's easy to forget that they didn't qualify for the last two major tournaments. They haven't been at the races since 2014. And Ronald Koeman comes in. He's obviously an elite coach who I think didn't really get the rub of the green at Everton. He deserves better. But, you know, the Netherlands is a great job to walk into. And he's worked wonders with that team. And, you know, four games ago, you would have said, well, yeah, they're still in transition, this team. But here we go. They're suddenly in the Nations League finals. They're in pot one for European Championship qualifying. They're reborn.
I think that's the big thing for them, being in pot one for the qualifying, because they missed out quite narrowly on the World Cup, right? They weren't miles away.
Mm.
And I think that escaping a bigger team in a group is going to be really, really big for them. And to be fair, like when you saw those groups drawn originally, if you'd said, right, the Netherlands are going to top the group from the last two world champions.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
Containing the last two world champions.
That's true.
Having not qualified for the last two major tournaments, you'd be like, yeah, right.
Yeah, I bet they draw Germany in the European Championship.
I know.
Qualifying.
Wow.
I know. And they'll beat them all over again.
Can I say this as well? This is huge what the Netherlands did.
Because yeah.
The Germany thing, that is the needle match. Like Netherlands-Germany is what England-Germany used to be to us before we got absolutely cleansed in the World Cup.
No, but this is the same thing. Like yeah. The Netherlands haven't been a genuine rival to Germany for
right.
a long time. So yeah, it's almost like a joke to Germans that the Netherlands are their rivals. But
and so for that to happen, for the two-all draw to happen psychologically, that is absolutely huge for this next new generation, this young generation of Dutch players. And you can draw a parallel with the victory over them over what was then West Germany in the yeah. Euros. Way back, was it 88 or 92, the semi-final?
Right? Mm-hmm.
Was it 88? I think it was the semi-final. And a parallel with that, like the kind of shedding of the historical burden for a generation. And that's happened again now, and it's so exciting for Holland.
I think the bedrock for their success has been their defence. I mean, it's difficult. I mean, I know Germany scored a couple of goals against them, but they are tough to get through. I mean, you've got Cillessen in goal, Van Dijk, of course. De Ligt, who you know is going to be one of the best centre backs in the world in the next few years, and they've got some good exciting fullbacks as well. And I think it's really cool that they've got that foundation in place.
This team actually reminds me of Southampton under Pochettino, when they had all these brilliant players we didn't know about yet. We knew about them, we didn't know about them, and we're going to see in the next 2-3 years players from this Holland team emerge into the international spotlight, and we're going to be like, of course, it was there all along. Yeah. Do you know, it's like almost this is almost like foreshadowing for the next 3-4 years.
Yeah, quite possibly.
Like De Jong as well, Frankie De Jong.
Yeah, well, this is the thing I was going to say, is that now you've started seeing the rumours for De Ligt and De Jong going to big clubs.
Yeah.
You know, they're both only 21.
And the De Ligt rumours have been around for a little while.
Yeah, but they seem to be more... Usually you kind of see them pop up on, you know, kind of like niche people in the people who really know. And now they're kind of... They right. seem to be everywhere for like the past week. Actually, I've seen so much stuff written about those two.
Yeah,
I think. Yeah, no, I you think, said defense is really good, and I think also their midfield, like Ronaldo and De Jong together, I think is just a really nice midfield.
Yeah,
and again, like under the radar, and I think the thing as well with the Holland is that, or the Netherlands, was for so long they've been hanging on to that old guard, you know, and looking to those guys to get them out of trouble.
Mm.
And as you maybe kind of see with Portugal, actually, if you remove the kind of the big dogs, if right. you like, sometimes it frees up this next generation to really kind of be, you know.
Well, we saw even that with England.
Yeah, or like Sweden, for example, when with, you know, they had their most successful World Cup for ages, the first time Zlatan wasn't there. And I think that's not saying that these guys are terrible, obviously, because they're not. But I think when you've got a personality that huge who can dominate a dressing room, sometimes... removing them and letting the younger guys come through is pretty good.
That's an excellent point. I think what also happens though with Zlatan and Cristiano Ronaldo is they make the attack predictable because things go through them.
Yeah.
And you know then who's coming to get you, basically. You look at Portugal now, much harder to pick up. That front line is basically amorphous.
Well, I think this became the problem with England as well, with Rooney. everything was going through Rooney and England became so predictable, so pedestrian. And then when they stripped him out of the team, you now don't know where the attack's coming from. Mm. It can be from any side of the pitch.
There's a parallel with Raul Gonzalez being let out of the Spain team and then winning.
Yeah, definitely.
And then also Ballack being left out before 06. And I think the problem is it's that teams, because the team has so long been built around that player, the opposition has worked out to beat you with that player configured like that. So it was when, you remember like the Euros final 2012, when basically Spain hunted Pirlo in packs. Mm-hmm. They basically filled the midfield with effectively six players at one point. Mm-hmm. You know how Spain just cluster. Mm-hmm. And they just hunted Pirlo down. Mm. And you take Pirlo out, not that he's not incredible, he's incredible, but that's the point, he's almost too good.
Yeah, yeah. It gives the opposition more to cover because there is no, you know, absolute target point. And that's the thing, with back then, even though there were probably more dangerous players in the Italy squad from an attacking point of view, it was all about kind of shutting Pirlo down.
And I think in international football, this is even more important. Like at club level, like we see teams try and fend off Messi, you know, but they're too good, you know, like they have options all over the pitch. At international football, you can't sign a player.
Yeah. I kind of like an international football a little bit to like when the NBA gets to the playoffs, right, for example, and sometimes teams who would have had like the third best record in their conference get wiped out by the team who had the eighth best record because it's just a matchup problem. Do you know what I mean? So it doesn't mean they're not as good a side, but they just, the way they match up, you know what I mean, specifically, is a lot more, it's a lot more specific for that kind of those two teams, do you know what I mean? As opposed to, and that doesn't necessarily mean that over the course of a season, that's why you don't see it in domestic leagues so much. But in those, in when you've only got four games to play, it kind of becomes
I love that analogy you've drawn. I think if you look at even some of the games we've seen, we see Switzerland and Belgium.
Yeah.
Switzerland match up very well. This is the thing, Switzerland have been matching up very well with teams for years in these big tournaments. Look how hard they were to beat the last couple of World Cups. Argentina, you know, with Messi peaking 2014, very difficult to break them down. It always takes till sort of injury time or extra time to beat them in big tournaments. So no one likes playing them. They're like a kind of, they're like a diet Uruguay. Do you know what I mean? They're not as dangerous as Uruguay. They're not as defensively good, but they're brutal. I mean, look, they were the only team to beat Spain in the 2010 World Cup finals, I think. So they're really, a really tough competitor. I'm actually so happy to see them in the last four with Holland and Portugal. And what I want to throw in quickly on Portugal, because this is important too, I just want to say how I'm so impressed by specific players, key players in that team have evolved this year. So Bernardo Silva has stepped up into the void as the eight when De Bruyne has been out. William Carvalho made an incredible move from the trash fire that was Sporting Lisbon's dressing room. The end of season trouble, God bless Sporting Lisbon, they had a tough season last year, to Betis. He's been great there. Mm. And
he's Renato brilliant. Sanchez, Sorry, but I love William Carvalho so much.
He's wonderful.
Yeah.
He's so underrated.
He's so underrated.
And final shout, Renato Sanchez looks happy again.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Sanchez is, he should be quite fortunate over the next couple of months that he's going to get a run in the Bayern team as well. I mean, Kovac seems to like him more than Jupp Heynckes did, but anyway, but with, you know, Tolisso, James Rodriguez, Thiago Alcantara all injured, he should get a run in that Bayern team. So he's kind of player he needs to be loved, you know? And he needs
All, Michael? One thing I want to say as well at the Nations League, more generally, we keep sort of looping back, is that you not only get to see who the form teams are, but you get to see players evolving in sort of real time. So it's like Sancho. Sancho's gone straight from being dominant at Dortmund to the national team, and there's such a kind of there's a real way of career progression now. You can actually chart progress so much better, not just at a, you know, the country international, but at a player level, and that's exciting. So for example, Ross Barkley, you know, as we discussed before, like doing really well as a number eight for Chelsea, into the national side, making an impact for Croatia and against Croatia. It's really great to see that.
Yeah, I realized for the first time on the weekend how I think I genuinely care about Jadon Sancho now. There was a point in the second half where I think Lovren pushed him And I like, just instinctively went, hey, leave him alone.
Leave the kid alone.
Like, and, yeah. And I was like, oh, right. We're there. We're there. Like, and that's, yeah, it's real.
Yeah. Wait till Reece Nelson makes his England debut.
Oh, don't.
Emotions.
Hold me.
Emotions.
It's going to happen soon.
Can I just say to the England team as well, I want to just say on this podcast, like, this is really nice. This is a really nice England team. I think Daniel Storey, writing for Football 365, mentioned this a while ago. But, you know, I am somebody who certainly has been concerned about English nationalism. I talked about this before in a different context.
Yeah.
The fact that I, you know, I love watching England, but I worry about the kind of the England aspect of it.
I think we all do.
But this team is just, you know what? It's just, it's the best of what England is, I think. Like, they're an absolute credit to their clubs, they're a credit to the national side, the way that Gareth Southgate conducts himself. Mm. They're just a great, you know, multicultural, multiracial, but it's not even about that. You watch them and you don't think about that stuff because it's rendered irrelevant. This is just a bunch of, you know, great colleagues working together for a collective goal, and that other stuff doesn't seem to matter.
Gareth Southgate sets a great example. You say it renders it irrelevant, but there's still that unfortunate minority of fans that that don't do their bit, you know, on the road especially. And Jack Pitbrook wrote a great piece in the Independent a few weeks ago when England were in Spain, about how there's a core of England fans that are letting England down, and there's still a unfortunately an element of that,
right?
But it's better than it was.
Yeah. I think the thing about this England team is that it just seems way more relatable than it has been for years. Like, obviously, they're multimillionaires and they're amazing at football, but they kind of remind me of, like, some of my friends. That sounds really weird and stupid to say, but, like, in terms of, like, that kind of dynamic, you know, it's, like, varying ages, especially when you kind of, I mean, you know, I kind of came up through, like, you know, music and stuff, so it's very diverse and it's very, you know, people from different backgrounds or people at different ages or stages in their career. And this, like, fusion of that and that chemistry is something that's really, like, it's just really relatable, you know.
Do you know what it reminds me of, actually, when you talk like this? It reminds me of, let me just, God rest his soul, the late, great Mac Miller. When Mac Miller passed away recently, obviously the great musician, a lot of his fans were heartbroken on a personal level because they kind of seen his growing pains. And I think a lot of us have kind of seen the growing pains of this England team, and it's relatable the whole way. There's not a kind of aloofness to it. There's not an arrogance. And there's a great thing that Wayne Rooney said. He said, you know, he was speaking to some ex-England players who were a bit jealous of England's success. And he was like, like, I've had my time. Like, we've had our time.
Yeah.
And they're doing it. And what I love about Rooney is you can tell that players in the dressing room on the train are happy for him.
Mm-hmm.
Because look, Rooney was a player who did push himself and went on longer, maybe he should have gone. But that was never out of selfishness. That was out of competitive desire. And Rooney was someone who is so graceful in terms of stepping away and allowing this team to flourish. And I think we're on the verge of something quite exciting now with England. And I don't even mean winning tournaments. What I mean is I can see England being regular quarterfinalists in major tournaments if they play to their best for the next, you know, 10 years. But yeah, I mean, if they play to their best, I can see that. And that's exciting. Just the knowledge that we have a team that's good enough to be in contention again.
Yeah. I mean, it's not even really that kind of is a priority for me. It's just actually, I quite look forward to England games now. And that's a little bit strange for me. I mean, I don't want to be one of these people who's like, oh, I don't care about England. But it was just, I just didn't really enjoy them that much. You know, it just wasn't a lot about it that I enjoyed a huge amount. And now I kind of just find this team a lot more enjoyable to watch. And yeah, so I mean, I was watching the Barcelona documentary last night, that Take the Ball, Pass the Ball. And there's a bit in there that Pep says, it's not a spoiler, but he says, you know, people won't remember the titles we won. They'll remember how we played.
Right.
And I think that's something that you're starting to see a little bit more with England. It's like, that was the thing about the World Cup for me. It wasn't, I was never really expecting us to go that far or to win the thing or that it was going to hashtag come home. But just the way that we were playing through the tournament was like, oh, this is great. This is
right.
This looks fluid and new and exciting. And that for me was the biggest takeaway from stuff, not necessarily winning things as much as we'd
goal,
love to.
Sterling's goal against Spain, actually, on that note, Sterling's goal against Spain was absolutely beautiful. Mm. Like, you know, the way it was played out from the back. I think one of the Croatia players said that Pickford is the best at playing the ball out from the back in the world, pretty much. Like one of the Croatia players or members of the coaches, which is a big, you know, I mean,
it's definitely the most hype.
Ter Stegen's.
The most hype about playing out.
Ter Stegen's probably, you know, an Alisson, whatever, but it was generous praise. Yeah. But it's so, you know, you're right. Like watching Fabian Delph beating men in midfield, when's the last time we saw this, him play with so much freedom?
Yeah.
When's the last time we saw these players just play with absolute abandon, like in collective sense?
I think Pep Guardiola deserves quite a lot of credit for the reinvention of Fabian Delph.
We spoke about this before, that you're seeing now with this England side the benefit of having genuinely like some of the world's best coaches in the Premier League over a sustained period of time.
Yeah, true.
And a lot of these players have come from clubs who have got either, you know, Klopp, Pochettino, Guardiola, now Sarri, you know, and you're seeing that, you know, I'd even put Eddie Howe in there because I think that his philosophy is very similar to some of those top coaches and his approach. So, you know, it's just exciting. It's nice.
But you know what? It's still a relatively recent change. I mean, I remember going to Wembley a year ago, just over a year ago, maybe England played Germany. It was, and this was before Germany's like real decline, 0-0. And from about the 70th minute, there were paper aeroplanes being thrown onto the pitch because the fans were bored. But, you know, I look back on that now and I think that that was almost like the start of this. Mm. It was like, this is, you know, Ruben Loftus-Cheek, I think, was man of the match in that game. He was really impressive. And we started to see that England are competitive against teams like Germany now. And then there was another game that it was a 0-0 against another big team that same week, I think. That was when it started to change.
The one thing I really hope is that people don't now expect stuff from this England side. That's the one thing that really concerns me. And where
I don't think so.
I hope they don't, because if people start expecting England to maintain a certain level, I think that you might see this kind of feeling towards them kind of dialogue.
England fans don't expect anything. There's been too many years of hurt, Ryan.
I think in a funny way, I think the country, this to get briefly political, I think the country has been humbled in lots of ways in recent years. And I think that actually has informed maybe the way that we relate to the national team to an extent, because, you know, we got humbled in the World Cup 2010. I think losing 4-1 to Germany, in my opinion, completely destroyed the England-Germany rivalry as a historical factor. I think now when we play Germany, it's kind of, oh, it's Germany, haha, two World Wars, one World Cup. But that's not really a thing anymore. Like, it's not, we're not neck and neck like we felt were before. And I think that the England football team now has been such a lovely way to kind of come together, unify, whatever word. It is such a nice way to sort of reinvent some sense of national identity in such a positive way. And it's just been really nice to root for this team. Without any other, does that make sense?
It makes complete sense. I mean,
it's just been really not just to root for them because
You haven't mentioned the B word of Brexit, but during that whole saga, which is still rumbling on, the World Cup felt like such an escape.
Mm-hmm.
And long may it continue.
What was really positive about stuff
the escapism,
like that?
Not Brexit.
Yeah, what was really positive was seeing people who were very kind of on the, you know, a certain side of the political spectrum try and claim ownership of the England side when they were doing well in the World Cup. And just everyone shutting them down,
right?
Which I thought was really good as well.
True.
England, yay.
Yeah, thanks England for restoring our emotional compass. Much
through to the playoffs. There's playoffs, right?
So exactly.
This is fun. It's all new and fun.
On that exciting emotional cliffhanger, we'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll discuss the fate of Germany. And we're back. So let's talk Germany, Michael. says it all. Oh, Germany.
I don't know what's going on with them. They're, you know, 2-0 up with 5 minutes to go against the Netherlands. Good team, Netherlands, as we discussed earlier. But that is a game they have to close out. You know, Kroos came back. Hummels was back. Müller came off the bench. I don't think there's any coincidence that Müller came off the bench and then they conceded two goals. Is that harsh? I don't know. I think that, you know, from what we saw against Russia last week when Germany won 3-0, Serge Gnabry, superb, and he should be a permanent fixture in the Germany team. Kai Havertz, really, really impressive. And I don't know why he didn't start. Leroy Sané did keep his place. But those three, Gnabry, Havertz, Sané, they should be the three that Germany are building their team around. Maybe with Marco Reus up top. He was injured, unfortunately, so he wasn't able to play a part only towards the tail end of the Netherlands game. But this transition towards youth is not happening. It's not happening quick enough. And... you know, Serge Gnabry should have stayed on that pitch for 90 minutes. He was absolutely superb, and he was against Russia, as I said. I think there's still many, many questions. I mean, I think Toni Kroos proved himself after a few unconvincing performances for Germany. But yeah, there's something psychologically wrong with them.
Kroos has been more confident in front of a microphone than on the pitch in some recent games. I'm sorry, but it has to be said. Kroos always seems to have words for fellow underperforming players.
Sané, let's just be honest.
You know, Kroos called out Sané, but Sané scored. And I hope that Sané's body language is appropriate when he was celebrating this time around.
Well, Sané is an interesting topic. He's back now after, well, obviously he was left out of the World Cup squad. 16 games it took him to score. He broke his duck against Russia and then scored again a really good goal against the Netherlands. I think he's proven that he should be there. I mean, I think Joachim Löw, the jury is still out. Most definitely the jury's still out on him. But I think I've made my views clear on him. I think it's time for him to go. I think there needs to be something fresh, some change. Even if that's in the shape of the 110-year-old Jupp Heynckes, but I think he could step in. I mean, I think he's a professional firefighter.
That's
harsh. He's a lot more than that.
Age-wise, he's a lot more than 100.
No, the firefighter bit.
I want nothing more. Well, that's a lie. In terms of German football-related stuff, yeah. Jupp Heynckes as Germany manager, I am take all my money.
You're on board with
it. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, me too.
He's just that guy.
It's almost like, like Wenger managing France at some point or something like that. Like, you know, a job that you would want to see a guy like that have, you know.
Yeah, it's perfect for the role. And he knows a lot of the players already. And Germany have got this, a bit like England in some ways, that they've got this great generation coming through. The difference is that Southgate knows how to get the best out of them and when to play them. And Löw just seems just hamstrung by indecision. He doesn't know which young players to play at what point, whether it's time to say goodbye to some older player. I mean, he's finally dropped Jerome Boateng, but that should have happened long ago. Mats Hummels is another guy that hasn't convinced. Toni Kroos has picked it up. Thomas Müller, I think, is lucky to still be involved at the moment, the way he's playing. But Löw just doesn't seem brave enough to make these decisions.
Can I just fire a few shots at the DFB? Because I think that they should take a lot of the blame here. Because giving Löw an extension to his contract before the World Cup started was so stupid. And I think it bred that arrogance that you saw in various stages through the World Cup, like from before the tournament, the language they were using, the selection, the way that they were going to play. There didn't seem to be any consequences for players who didn't perform, like Hummels, Müller, Boateng, Kroos, for example, that kind of core. They've made it really difficult to move on from Löw because, I mean, there's a lot of parallels with Arsene Wenger at Arsenal, for example. For years and years and years, people were saying he's got to go. But when does a manager feel that they can't do a better job or turn things around? It's very rare. You know, managers are wired different to normal people. And like Germany against Sweden in the World Cup is the only competitive fixture that they've won since October last year, which was against Azerbaijan. Now, when would an organisation like the DFB let that stand?
And do you know what? The warning signs for Germany were there, like before the World Cup. They played Saudi Arabia in a warm-up game. Mm-hmm. They were abysmal in
the
that game. They won 2-1, but it was like I think the winning goal turned out to be an own goal, and then they conceded towards the end, and it was like a nervy, they just about got over the finish line. I remember watching that game thinking, Germany don't look in great shape. I didn't think that the World Cup would be as catastrophic as it was, but to think that this has just suddenly happened, that the World Cup is wrong. Mm. And you're right to raise the DFB's failings because this stretches back.
Yeah. I'm also personally of the belief that if you win the World Cup as a manager, just walk, because it's not going to get any better for it. But and I think there are examples where it's different, and I'll mention them. I think Deschamps at France is different because I honestly think France won that ahead of schedule.
Yeah, they're still on the rise.
They're not developed.
Yeah.
Spain were different because there was such a depth of talent across multiple ages at people in various stages of their career, and the core of that squad were either at Real Madrid or Barcelona. And I just think Del Bosque, it was a bit of an anomaly. It was like one of the perfect situations where you could see this dynastic squad that would be able to win. I think it's, in Germany's case, you either win the World Cup and then go, right, you kind of reboot and you then start planning for the next one, you know, get people kind of blooded in or whatever, or you just be like, this is someone else's job, like freshen it up. It's that kind of, it just seemed really stale, the whole thing. This is stuff we've covered, so I won't go over it too much.
No, but I can just see, you know, why Love, and this is in defense of, in defense of the DFB, it's so interesting. If you look at how the national team has evolved under Love, you know, this guy basically resurrected it. 06, I think he took, was it 06, 08, I think it was?
Yeah, 06.
Yeah. 06. And, you know, how long is that now? 12 years.
Yeah.
That is like a sort of Angela Merkel length tenure under whom, you know, and he basically is responsible for so much of the...
He's gone the same way as Merkel as well.
Yeah, yeah. But
one thing that's often forgotten as well is that Germany were the best, arguably, but they were the best team going to Euro 2012 as well. And they should have won that tournament, and they actually underachieved by not winning. I mean, it's a fair criticism. You can't win every tournament, but they peaked in 2014, and as you say, it was the cycle was complete at that point. And the trend for the last 4 years has been a downward one, a
slow decline. I mean, the problem is, although they peaked in 2014, they were still very competitive in 2016. And they only narrowly got done by France. Basically, Pogba just went to town on Kimmich, and that was that.
That's true. That's true.
So it was, and the thing with the DFB as well, and this is maybe why Löw has been there so long. He is so good, you know, off the court, in quote marks. Mm. He is just a consummate diplomat. He is worldly. He's engaging. He's just an incredible figurehead. You know, when do you ever hear like really bad stuff about Löw in the public sphere on an international basis? Like he's well regarded in an international basis. Like, I don't mean in Germany. I mean, in English speaking media, Löw comes across really well. And that's...
He's professional. I don't think anyone's questioning his, that side of him.
But that's what I'm saying. That's why he's probably been there for so long. It's not just the results on the pitch. He's a really good company man. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's just all a bit comfortable, and he's such a safe... He's such a safe pair of hands.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. Like, I mean,
it's gridlock, basically.
When I kind of say that he should have walked, this isn't like me being like, oh, Love is like rubbish or whatever, because you don't win the World Cup by being rubbish. And the thing is, something Michael said was that, you know, the jury's still out on Love and the guy has won a World Cup. That kind of saddens me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That's the, like, without getting too kind of like...
Well, there's an emotional attachment to Love, which is, I think if he hadn't won the World Cup, or say you're taking them to the final in 2014, he'd be long gone. It's this kind of, this thinking, oh, well, maybe he can do it again. Mm.
There are so many parallels to Wenger at Arsenal. Yeah. It's crazy. I think more for him, it's like he did such an amazing job. And he has done such an amazing job for Germany that the longer that he stays on, in terms of, well, providing they don't turn it around in the qualifiers and like have a strong qualifying campaign, it's just going to tarnish that amazing legacy of bringing the World Cup.
Exactly.
Back to Germany.
And there's no, like, we've not really seen during his tenure, and why would we, any signs of discontent? But we saw against the Netherlands a sign, you know, a banner being held up, Lerf Rouse. So, Lerf out. Now, if you look closely as well, I think you can see Michael Ballack standing behind that.
Mr. Ballack, if you listen to this podcast, we'd love to have you on again to discuss that point of
contact. He's not going to come on now, is he? Michael threw him under the bus.
No, but really, I think the handling of the Özil Gundogan situation as well wasn't perfect. That wasn't just him, it was actually more the DFB. But there's this kind of feeling of like, we need to draw a line under this, and we need to start, not again, because there's so many good young players that have already been brought into the team, but that hasn't happened quick enough. And I think there needs to be a fresh impetus. And you've mentioned Arsenal a couple of times in the parallel to Wenger. Look what it's done for Arsenal.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, someone new in there, again, it's kind of not saying Love is washed or anything. I just think it instantly just relieves a lot of the pressure that's around Germany at the moment. And there is a hell of a lot of pressure.
The sad thing is that it would be, in my opinion, great for Germany to make a change, but it would be kind of the end for Le. Like, where does he go from here? I mean, football's a kind of a brutal business, but I don't think there's much more he can do, really.
I think that he could walk into another international job, I think, pretty easily. I think, but it wouldn't be at a top tier. You know, I think it would be a country that's like, you know, even I wouldn't say someone like the US, but some that kind of. Yeah. I think he could go somewhere like that, or I'm not sure about a job at club level. And this again, if he'd gone after the World Cup, he would have walked into any job in the world, pretty much. I think at that point,
it's wherever he goes, it's going to be a step down, and he's never really proved himself convincingly as a club.
Yeah,
coach. So, yeah, it's kind of like he's kind of at a dead end, really.
Yeah. Poor Yogi.
Poor Yogi, indeed.
I don't want anyone to think that I've got a campaign against him. Like,
how are we going to get anywhere? Listen.
But I've been calling for him to leave.
No, this is a different point. Listen, it's all a bit cozy in here. I like a bit of controversy in the podcast. You know, listen, say it with your chest. You know, if you're holding a banner right now saying Love Rouse, you know, then no.
That was
right.
Michael who let was me, holding that up.
Let me just get my banner out of my
head. Yeah. Michael's holding up one saying Moussa Rouse.
Yeah.
Moussa
Rouse.
Hey, there's no harm in some nuance, Moussa. You know that.
Well, yeah, I would.
Scorching hot take. That's true.
Speaking of hot takes, let's jump across the ocean and go to a country which is making headlines politically and in football terms at the moment. Brazil. Neymar is a man who is as controversial as they come on the football field.
Sorry to butt in, but is Milton Keynes across an ocean?
Well, Brazil, last time I checked, was across the nation. I mean, we can always...
All right, I just thought because they played in Milton Keynes.
Let me just consult Google Maps.
I can confirm it's across the nation.
Yeah, yeah. Brazil beating Cameroon 1-0, Clarence Seedorf's Cameroon 1-0. Goal from Richarlison. Slight injury to Neymar. How are we assessing Brazil at the moment?
Firstly, I think Neymar's injury could... Possibly, it looks serious enough that he could stay out of the Liverpool game.
I think he's definitely going to miss the Liverpool game. That's next week, right? I think he did his hamstring.
Yeah. So that, and Mbappe got injured as well, but I think that looks less serious. I think Brazil, I watched that game and Willian he's such a class player, and he still, I feel, doesn't get the recognition he deserves. He absolutely run that game. He got a bit too much time and space and he should be given, I guess, and Seedorf will be working on that. But he was really good, and Richarlison really impressed me as well. Great header to win that game.
He's ace.
He's
so good.
What did you say about him earlier?
I said he looks like you've created him in FIFA, like his features. Do you know what I mean? Like he's like quite a striking guy. And he's a really good footballer.
How old is he? 19?
22? 21?
Oh, okay.
Maybe he just appeared from the ether, like, you know, the FIFA algorithm just manifested in the dressing room.
He's class.
He's great.
He's a star in the making.
And he is a very well-scouted player, because he's somebody who, frankly, was not on the international radar 3 years ago and now is a fixture. Like, he belongs in...
Who would have thought it of a £50 million football player?
listen, I'm just giving a shout out to the fantastic scouting at Watford, because those people were obviously smoking the good stuff. Like, whatever, like they knew what they were doing when they got him on board.
Where was he signed from?
I'm not sure where he came from.
What's knowledge?
Google it.
Hang on.
Google it.
Oh, Fluminense.
Fluminense.
After a brief stint at Mineiro.
Well, I mean, the reason I say good scouting is, you know, Fluminense is not exactly a small team, but it's understanding there'll be a good cultural fit between his style and the Premier League, because that transition is not easy to make.
Yeah.
I think Watford did the same again with Pereira, didn't they? He spent some time at River Plate and they brought him to Watford and he's been great. And it's just knowing or having a sense or a good amount of confidence that a player can shift like that.
Yeah.
I think South America is going to be the new kind of like Ligue 2 for Premier League scouting. Seems to be a little bit neglected maybe in the Premier League specifically over the last few years.
It goes in cycles, doesn't it, South America, doesn't it? Because I remember River Plate a few years ago, actually, when they had all the games on Channel 5, I used to watch them quite a lot. They had a guy, was it Fernando Cavanaghi, who was a kind of like young, finished like sort of Saviola / Crespo type finisher. And they had all these brilliant players and they got their moves to Europe. And then it went quiet a bit.
Yeah, well, there was the
it's
the
kind
wave
of heating up again, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, there's been the wave of the strikers for a long time, which I remember, sorry not to mention his name again, but I remember Arsene Wenger saying that commenting on the trend of South American strikers was because they were, you know, to touch on a brilliant piece that you recently wrote, Musa, more
make me blush.
Like unstable elements. They were kind of street footballers who hadn't been through the very homogenized academy structure in Europe, and bringing that level of a little bit of instability on the pitch and like unpredictability.
Hard to play against, right?
Yeah, definitely. I'm wondering whether you'll see that kind of outside of the out-and-out striker role.
This circles back to the point about Germany and why they're actually easy to play against now. You know, the Thomas Müller thing about finding space. Now that you know how Müller finds space, it's easy to plan against him. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's why the problem is these tactical cycles in football, they come to an end. You know, well, tiki-taka, not quite. It's not tiki-taka, but Guardiola style of football, you could argue. Well, it's because Xavi got knackered. But these cycles come to a natural end. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I'm being reductive, but you could argue that you need to freshen up and actually bringing in, as you say, players in these countries, unpredictable players. It gives us new challenges, new problems. Mm. I mean, I was watching Juventus against United in the Champions League and they put Pjanic at the back of the midfield.
Yeah.
And I, first, I was like, what are you doing there? But then they destroyed us.
So clever.
They destroyed us. I mean,
he dictates the game from such a deep position. Reminds me a lot of Jorginho, actually, in the way he plays.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I've completely forgotten what we were talking about.
Honest admissions, honest content on the podcast there. We got it all for you today. I know we've talked about South America briefly, and we could talk about Uruguay and the friendly against France, but I want to talk about France specifically. Because to me, their recent games have shown a lack of strength and depth in creative midfield, maybe. Maybe I'm leaping ahead a bit, but you look at the midfield they played Nzonzi, Kante and Matuidi, right? Pogba was out with an injury. And they looked like, against Netherlands, it looked lifeless. And I just wonder if they're going to have a challenge getting the ball into the feet of they're brilliant strikers.
It's not really a hub of creativity, those three, is it?
Well, exactly. This is what I'm saying. You know the threat's going to come through certain creative players. Mm. So I just think that France, for the next tournament, have to freshen up. And I think this Nations League has been a bit of a warning sign for them.
Mm-hmm. It has, and they've got away with it by finishing second and there being no like damage. They've kept their pot one status. Of course they would as world champions. But yeah, they seem a bit hungover.
A little bit rigid, I think, for in terms of system. I would have liked personally to have seen Deschamps experiment a little bit more.
Mm. And he's got so many players at his disposal to do that. I mean, Fekir and Dembele, who was also on the bench, these are guys that in these kind of games start.
Dramatic prediction. Deschamps conservative and cost France in Euro 2016. And I think it will cost them in 2020.
Ooh.
If things continue as they are, like you just can't. What's that saying that political theorist like reform that you may preserve? And I'm not sure whether he will reform. I think he has to take the Euros, the UEFA Nations League, as a bit of a shock, and then come back and be like, okay.
Are you saying he possibly should have left after winning the World Cup?
No, I'm just saying more risks. Just saying take more risks.
He's Didier Deschamps. It's not in his DNA to take risks.
Yeah, I mean that was a constant criticism of people before the World Cup, though. And actually, in the early stages of the World Cup, they were saying that they were a little bit too dull or defensive and not lively enough going forward. And I thought this would have been a great time, actually. It's a bit of a free hit for France, like you said. They're not going to really be out of the pot one thing because of the winning the World Cup. You're riding on that wave of kind of good feeling post World Cup. Mm. Go wild a little bit, and then actually, if it doesn't work, at least you've shown that you've tried to Do yeah, it. Yeah. Check us out telling international, World Cup winning managers how they should pick their sides.
It's all you, Ryan.
I know. Can you manage? How I can't.
But yeah, I mean, it's nothing too serious for France. I think it's just tweaking and a lot
of injuries as well, right?
But let's not expect France to. I mean, they've got some flair players, but don't expect them to be a flair team.
No, that's. Isn't it sad how we've just accepted? Oh yeah, France are always just going to counterpunch.
Yeah.
But then I saw a very interesting comment from Paul Pogba. Pogba's obviously one of my favourite players, but in a very unguarded moment, Pogba said, to be honest, we thought we'd won the Euros in 2016 after beating Germany. We thought it was a final. And I thought to myself, that is an absolutely astonishing admission. Every now and again, like, I love the French team, but every now and again, their players come out with stuff that makes me think, you people on a different planet. Mm. Like the Griezmann video, like I'm staying at Atletico, that whole documentary doesn't say he's staying. I'm like, completely.
To Drake in the background as well.
And then Pogba saying, like, we thought, can you imagine? Roy Keane would have had kittens if Roy Keane heard a player saying, we thought.
Segue.
Funny you mentioned Roy Keane.
Oh, Roy Keane, what's he done now?
Sound the alarm.
Yeah, Roy Keane and Martin O'Neill both no longer in charge of Ireland.
Wow, they've left.
They've left by mutual consent after, O'Neill had been in the job since November 2013, which is when the first issue of Rabona came out, incidentally.
So it's your fault.
So you've outlived O'Neill.
And yeah.
Martin O'Neill got sick of waiting for another issue and just quit. Couldn't take it anymore.
Don't blame him. But yeah, he'd only won one of 9 games this year and not a great record. But, Martin O'Neill, he knows what he's doing. And Ireland are not, let's just say you look back at the golden generation of, 15 years ago, Damien Duff, Roy Keane, Robbie Keane, these kind of players, Shay Given, they're miles away from that now. And I think there's some deeper problems in the infrastructure of Irish football than just firing a coach. He allegedly fired. He hasn't actually.
But maybe it's just the end of a cycle. I mean, 5 years is a long time. It's a long time in any job, international otherwise.
Tell Joachim Löw that.
Leave it alone.
Wow. It does sound like an agenda. I'm not being funny, but like the rule for an agenda. I'm just establishing some podcast.
Michael's a paid actor.
The sheriff is in town. We don't have enough rules in this podcast. I think that three strikes at one individual is an agenda.
Yeah.
Constitutes an agenda. I think we've had at least two on this podcast.
I think he needs a one pod ban.
I think, yeah, exactly. I think one more. That's a yellow card, Michael.
One more and it's a campaign.
Yeah, one more and it's a campaign. This is feeling like, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but this is feeling like a
violent conduct. It's 3 matches.
Yeah, it's shocking.
Jupp Heynckes said he'd pay me every time I called for Löw's head. That's,
but you mean Uncle Jupp to you.
My goodness, it's heating up in here. Who would
have
thought?
Can we go?
Yeah, we can go. I'll tell you what I will say is it's 1 degree in Berlin, but that's as hot a podcast as you're going to hear. See what I did there?
-3 with the -3 refill. Refill? Real fill.
Real fill. Sorry. Someone's got to put Ryan's new batteries in.
Yeah.
Dear listeners, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you with us. Thank you for joining us on a journey through the UEFA Nations League, and we hope you've enjoyed as much as we have. Please find us on all social media platforms. At Rabona Mag is the handle. You'll also check our website, if you don't mind, at rabonamag.com, where there is
just
lots of new content. Yeah, Rabona Mag, is it?
Just rabonamag.com.
Yeah. Where you'll find lots of new articles about the game and where things are at the moment. And we'll see you all next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.